Knowledge Products presents The Giants of Philosophy, Socrates, narrated by Lynn Redgrave. Part 5.
Does Socrates already know the answers to the questions he asks? The suspicion has been with us for a very long time. Many of Socrates' contemporaries would have agreed with Thrasymachus, who spoke these frustrated and accusing words to Socrates.
I knew it and predicted it. When it came time for you to reply, you would refuse and be ironical and do anything rather than answer some question that someone might ask you.
This suspicion has become virtually canonized in our modern conception of the teaching technique known as the Socratic method. In this method, a teacher asks leading questions that force the students themselves to think their way through to the correct understanding of a subject. The Socratic method is often considered to be superior to lecturing because it requires the students to think for themselves. The students arrive at knowledge with assistance, of course, because they have actively worked through the problems rather than passively listening to someone who already has a correct understanding. No doubt this style of teaching got its name because the one thing Socrates did most often was to ask leading questions. So how could anyone teach this way effectively without already having some answer in mind? It's important to be cautious about supposing that Socrates used what we now call the Socratic method of teaching. One reason for caution is that Socrates always claims that he does not have the knowledge he's pursuing in his conversations. Other teachers who use the Socratic method may occasionally and playfully claim not to know what the right answers are, but few students are fooled by their pose. By contrast, Socrates proclaims his ignorance, and he often proclaims it in situations where such a pose would have no teaching purpose. In other words, he does not just profess ignorance as he lures others into a trap, he also confesses his ignorance at the end of the conversations that have ended in failure. And he sometimes shows despair and frustration when conversations have seemed to lead in fruitless circles. Socratic teachers, as they are called, do know the answers to their questions. Socrates often seems genuinely not to know. In fact, he made this claim of ignorance the center of his defense at his trial. There is a second reason for caution. If Socrates does have the knowledge that his questions are trying to elicit, we would be forced to conclude that he is a terrible teacher, because Socrates' interlocutors usually end up just confused and annoyed. In Plato's earlier dialogues, no one seems to learn anything positive at all. Whatever Socrates is doing, he is not leading his interlocutors in the way a so-called Socratic teacher leads a student. Socrates seems to be sincere in professing his ignorance. Admittedly, he often deploys his ignorance to prepare haughty and arrogant victims for his penetrating questions, but this does not invalidate his claim. It is important to realize that Socrates' profession of ignorance does not make him a skeptic. He does not deny that knowledge is possible for human beings, nor does he claim to lack all forms of knowledge himself. Quite to the contrary. Socrates acknowledges that people do have many sorts of knowledge, and he claims some types of knowledge for himself. For example, he acknowledges that artisans know their crafts and reliably produce their wares. But like others, artisans are unwise because they don't know their own limitations.
The good craftsmen seem to me to make the same mistake as the good poets. Because he performs his craft well, each considered himself to be wisest about other things, the most important things. And this error of theirs obscured their wisdom. So that I asked myself, on behalf of the oracle, whether I should prefer to be as I am, neither wise with respect to their wisdom, nor ignorant with respect to their ignorance, or to have both things that they have. I then answered myself and the oracle that it is better to be as I am.
Exactly what are these other things that are beyond the wisdom of Socrates or the craftsman? Here, Socrates is probably referring to wisdom or understanding about the most important ethical terms. Neither Socrates nor Thrasymachus nor the craftsman know what justice is. Neither Socrates nor Euthyphro nor the craftsman know what piety is, and so on. What makes Socrates the wisest of men is that, unlike Euthyphro and the craftsman, he doesn't think he knows what these most important things are. He reveals the ignorance of others with his questioning, and he acknowledges his own ignorance from the outset. Our puzzle remains. If Socrates is ignorant, how can he be so good at questioning others? Of course, Socrates is like the craftsman in that his ignorance is not complete. He does know some things, and he employs his knowledge in conversations with others. For example, Socrates famously proclaims that he knows nothing about what might come after death. In speaking to the jury that would convict him, he contrasted this ignorance about the afterlife with his knowledge that it is evil and disgraceful to do wrong and to disobey a superior, whether God or man. In Plato's work entitled Apology, Socrates makes this point.
Perhaps I am different from most men in this way. If I say I am wiser, namely that in not knowing much about Hades, I do not think that I know. But I do know that to do injustice and to disobey one's superior is evil and disgraceful, and I will never fear and flee from what may turn out to be goods before what I know to be evils.
Socrates says he will not abandon his religious mission as a gadfly, even if it costs his life. With this conviction, he refutes those who try to persuade him to stop his irritating philosophizing. But Socrates also has a great deal of experience in discussing what he calls the most important things, even if he does not know what justice is. By leading the examined life, he can determine what justice is not. He can examine many points of view, and he can determine that some of them cannot be maintained. Socrates' long experience allows him to recognize that what he calls the reasons of iron and adamant support certain views and refute others. In fact, careful reflection shows that some views are simply ridiculous. According to Socrates, such experience does not produce what he calls knowledge or wisdom. After all, tomorrow a new argument might overturn one's view on some matter. Take the concept of justice as an example. Unless Socrates can come to know what justice is, he will never be an unerring judge of what is just and what is not just. To know what justice is would make Socrates wise, and Socrates denies that he has any such knowledge. He may know that certain cases are assuredly just or unjust, such as disobeying one's superiors. But knowing the justice of one case does not make Socrates an infallible judge of all cases. Analogies and comparisons between cases could turn out to be false. To avoid error, Socrates is convinced that he would have to know what justice is, in and of itself. When he calls himself ignorant, what Socrates means is that he does not know what justice is and that he does not know what the other most important things are. He may be able to judge individual cases. In fact, he shows no hesitation in judging a great many cases. Moreover, his depth of experience in leading the examined life gives him a great advantage in arguing with others. It permits him to ask just the right questions and to reveal the ignorance of those who think they know. But despite all his experience and learning, Socrates is significantly short of his ultimate goal of definitive knowledge, or what he calls wisdom. He may get endlessly closer and closer to his goal, but Socrates believes that only the gods are truly wise. Age known as the Enlightenment swept Europe in the 18th century, Western ethics has been concerned primarily with seeking the right principles by which to guide our actions. For the philosophers of ancient Greece, ethics was typically an investigation of happiness, or what they called eudaimonia. What is happiness, and how can it be acquired? Greek philosophers simply assumed that people take happiness, or what they sometimes describe as doing well or living well, to be the ultimate goal of all actions. We see how deeply ingrained this assumption is in a remark that Socrates makes in Plato's early dialogue, Euthydemus.
Then do all men wish to do well? Or is this question one of those ridiculous ones we were afraid of just now? Isn't it clearly absurd to ask such things? Is there anyone who does not wish to do well?
To enjoy the fullest degree of eudaimonia, many Greeks assume that one must first attain arete, which means virtue or excellence. But the Greeks disagree about what arete is. Socrates established the course of the debate by arguing that arete is really moral arete. He says a person is happiest only if he or she acquires moral virtue. For many Greeks, this idea alone was hard enough to swallow, but Socrates was even more at odds with common Greek opinion when he said that moral virtue has nothing to do with wealth or power or prestige. He said it is really a kind of knowledge. Moral virtue enables a person to distinguish good from evil, and it enables one to explain why something is good and why something is evil. To illustrate what he has in mind, Socrates often draws analogies between virtue and various crafts, such as medicine or architecture, which are also types of knowledge. It was not at all unusual for Socrates to question someone at length about the characteristics of crafts in order to make a point about the nature of virtue. Consider an interchange that Socrates had with Euthyphro, a self-styled expert on religious law who turns out to be phony and self-deceived. Socrates begins by asking,
"Can you tell me what product the craft of the physicians happens to produce? Isn't it health?"
"Clearly."
"And what is the product of the shipbuilder's craft?"
"Ships, obviously."
"And the house builder produces a house?"
"Yes."
Socrates uses these maddeningly commonplace examples to demonstrate that knowing a craft's goal should allow us to understand what knowledge the craft requires. For example, by knowing something about the goals of medicine, when we discover the goals that virtue seeks, we can then know what knowledge the doctor must have. Similarly, we can know what knowledge a virtuous person must have. Euthyphro, like those who converse with Socrates in Plato's early dialogues, is unable to give Socrates an acceptable answer about the goal or purpose of virtue. When the dialogue ends, it's apparent that no one yet understands what sort of knowledge is needed by a virtuous person. But at the end of another dialogue, entitled Laches, Socrates seems confident that virtue is concerned with good and evil. He tells the famous general Nicias,
"Do you think there could be anything missing from the virtue of such a one who knew all good things and everything about how they come about and will come about and came about, and similarly about evils? Do you think such a person would be lacking in either temperance or justice and piety when it belongs to this man alone to be able to distinguish what is and is not to be feared regarding the gods and men, and the gaining of good things, since he would know the right way to be concerned with these things?"
So what is happiness concerned with? On this topic, Plato's dialogue entitled Gorgias is especially helpful. Here, Socrates handily refutes the claim by Callicles that happiness, or what Callicles calls doing well, is just a matter of feeling pleasure. This was a popular and widely held notion in his own day, just as it is in ours, but Socrates challenged it.
"Well, do you say it is impossible to do well and do ill at the same time?"
"I do say so."
"But you agree that it is possible to enjoy oneself when one is in pain?"
"It appears so."
"Then enjoyment is not the same as faring well, nor is feeling pain the same as faring ill, with the result that pleasure is different from the good."
For Socrates, happiness is not a feeling at all. It is a matter of how we act, and he describes happiness as acting well.
The good man acts well and nobly in whatever he does. And the one who acts well is blessed and happy, whereas the bad man who acts wickedly is miserable.
If Socrates is right, then virtue is a kind of knowledge about what it means to act well. This is not to say that Socrates thinks virtue guarantees that we will always act well. Indeed, virtue cannot guarantee happiness. Socrates says elsewhere that there are goods other than virtue, such as health, prosperity, and even physical attractiveness. So if happiness consists in acting properly, then these other non-moral goods must be valuable because they enable us to act rightly. Without these other goods, right action would be difficult or impossible. So Socrates seems to think that to be happy, we must have a full range of goods or advantages. But Socrates is careful to point out that such things as health and wealth do not stand on the same moral plane as virtue. He notes that other goods, such as wealth or good looks, can be used for evil purposes.
It seems likely that the whole collection, health, wealth, and good looks, that we at first said are good things, are not goods by nature. But rather, it looks as if any of them is led by ignorance, they are greater evils than their opposites, inasmuch as they are more able to serve an evil leader. But if intelligence and wisdom guide them, they are greater goods. In themselves, they are of no value.
Socrates' point is that only moral wisdom is good by its very nature. It is the only thing whose very nature always makes a person better off. Other things such as health and wealth can be good, but they are good only if they are employed rightly. Their goodness is not intrinsic. They are good only if they are used correctly. And this, in turn, requires moral wisdom.
This is the end of part 5. Please download part 6 to continue.